Paul's message is clearly one of the most hopeful messages for kind of refugee seats coming to Colombia. Hopeful, that is, in the sense that I've had to keep it extensively to myself before I could come to bring it to you. Last week, you remember, we talked about how the New Testament gives us a number of commands concerning what we should do toward one another. And the prominent among the many commands are two themes: that we should love one another, that we talked about last week, and that we should serve one another, if we consider Christmas. Many times the New Testament tells us that we should serve one another. For instance, in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 13, we're told, "You, my brothers, are called to be free. But do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love." There's a number of other references, including the righteousness and the bones and outline, which speak to the same issue. But I find this command, "Rather, serve one another in love," to be well illustrated and understood by an incident that occurred in Jesus' life and the teaching of Jesus that was at the very heart of that incident, recorded in Matthew chapter 20 in verse 25 to 28. And let's turn together in our Bibles, Matthew chapter 20. And we want to take a look at that incident, beginning with verse 17. Matthew chapter 20, beginning with verse 17. Now as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed. Betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and will condemn him to death, and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day he will be raised to life." Now then, the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked to favor of him. "What is it to them?" He said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your kingdom." "And you don't know what you're asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you break the cup I'm going to break?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink of my cup. But to sit at my right or at my left is not for me to go. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." Now when the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so, excuse me. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for men." As Jesus and his disciples were leaving there, came a large crowd following them. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked him and told him to be quiet. But they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." Jesus stopped and called them. "What do you want me to do for you?" "Lord, they answered, we want our sight." Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. Immediately they received their sight and followed him. The first delay, brief moment now, to impress upon these things and how they come from each one of the things. Lord, these are powerful truths we ask you to hear. Open our understanding of that and receive it. Make them all and to see you in it. Help us now, my God. I want to deal in this chapter concerning servanthood. And the four things that you see outlined, the occasion of the lesson is Jesus' thing, the lesson itself, the illustration of the lesson, and then the application of the lesson to us. First of all, the occasion of the lesson. You see that in verses 17 to 24. In verse 17, we read, "Now as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside. They're on their way to Jerusalem, and Jesus is again going to prepare the disciples by revealing to them what is about to take place when they arrive at Jerusalem. Now, in order to be going to tell them this, not to elicit sympathy, but in order to prepare them and to help their faith. And so he says in verse 18, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, and will turn him over to the Gentiles, be mocked, and flogged, and crucified. And the third day he will be raised to life." A very specific revelation telling what's going to happen to him. And it's a good thing that he did this to prepare them and not to gain any sympathy. Because in fact, we know that now. In fact, right on the heels of this revelation concerning his own death and his torture, and the amazing revelation that he's going to be raised to life, that's the next thing we need. There's a James and John, and Mark tells us that they're involved in this, along with their mother, come up and they ask him a question. And so they come in verse 20, we read, "The mother of Zebedee's son came to Jesus with his sons and kneeling down to ask a favor." Mark tells us in his account that the words that they use are, "Lord, we want you to do whatever we ask of you. Is that okay?" Sort of reminds me of that when my daughter could come to me and say, "Daddy, would you promise to do whatever we ask?" They sort of clues you into, now here's one of all requests that you better not say, "Oh, sure, whatever you ask." So Jesus doesn't do that. His immediate response is, "What is it that you want me to promise that I'm going to do before you ask me even what it is?" Well, it's not only, not much, I just thought maybe it'd be nice if you could just give me an assurance that my two sons will be the greatest in the kingdom. I know you love them a lot, and that's certainly not too much to ask, is it? And of course, Jesus' response to them, in verse 22, you don't know what to ask them. It's really the most ironic request they could have made at that point. Not only does it indicate a total insensitivity to what Jesus has just said about his own death and his own humiliation, but it flies right in the face of the lessons that he's just given to them. True, they don't know what they're asking. Because the very nature of what will be given here comes through humility. Jesus had just said, you notice back in chapter 19 and 20, in other places, in Mark chapter 19 and verse 30, he had just given them a parable to teach that many who are first are going to be last. That many who place themselves first are going to be last. And many of those who are in fact appear to be last are going to be the ones made first. And then in chapter 20, verse 16, that we told another parable about the working. He concludes that with, "So, the last, those who are in the low position, are going to be first, and those who are first, they're going to be put down last." And just right after that, these two sons and another come and say, "Now, would you make us first?" Clearly, they haven't heard what he's been talking about. And Jesus is trying to then use this as a means of helping them understand what he's getting at. So this is related to drinking the cup that I drink. Well, can you do that? Well, of course you can. You know, they tell you that as glibly. If you then more soberly bring to their attention, in fact, they are going to suffer. More than they could realize, they think. But it's the height of presumption to think that their suffering will merit for them the greatest place in the kingdom, that they will be made last to that degree that they will be exalted to faith. But now, you see, it's very disheartening to be sure for Jesus to hear this kind of response to his people. He's not only just told them about this very point, he's just poured himself out to them about his death, and all they think about is himself. He's going to be great. But then we read in verse 24 that the others come in. Surely somebody sat in the point, and they're going to respond. And what do we read in verse 22? When the Talmud heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Yes, finally there's some insight in this class. Somebody's indignant with the insensitivity of these guys. They're going to stand up and say, you insensitive, incomprehending jerk, how could you say such a thing after what the Lord just told you about? Is that what they do? On the contrary, they're indignant because the other two beat them to the punch. But what they're indignant about is that's what we had in mind. You two guys got to invest. In fact, Luke tells us that after the Lord's Supper in chapter 22, they're still arguing, all 12 of them, about who's going to be the first in the kingdom. There's only 11 at that point, not arguing, but who's going to be the first in the kingdom? And so their indignation is really not an indignation concerning the insensitivity and the obtuseness of those two fellows, but it's rather because they've missed out on being first themselves. Now, again, surely Jesus is going to be totally disheartened if he wasn't before. Now, concerning the response of these people and the rest of these people. But what does he do? In implementation, we see here one of the best examples of Jesus' tenderness, I think, that we have in all of the scriptures. Because even after such a response as this, Jesus uses this gently and patiently as an opportunity to teach. To teach them a vital and valuable lesson about servanthood. And what does he say? You see the lesson itself in verses 25 to 28. And it has three parts to it. First, he draws for them a contrast. A contrast between two kinds of greatness. Jesus says basically that in the world there are two kinds of greatness. First of all, there's the greatness that the Gentiles, the world has. And that's a greatness that says this. The greatness is measured by who you can lord over, who you can impress with your authority. A greatness is measured by how many people you boss around. Greatness is measured by who jumps when you speak. A greatness is measured for you kids by who you can have play with you, and then just go off and put them down, and then come back and have them ask you to play with them again. Greatness is measured by who you can string along and who you can keep dangling in your life. Greatness is measured in the eyes of many women with pressure coming in our culture today by the fact that I've got to carve out a career that will give me recognition in the world rather than the lonely position in the eyes of the world of staying at home to be a wife and a mother. A greatness is measured by how many people recognize that I'm a big guy. Jesus says that's one of your things. Then he says in verse 25, notice, verse 26, contrasting to that, the NIV brings out beautifully the force of the Greek here because that's literally what he says, not so with you. Not so with you. He's drawing here a radical and a significant, emphatic contrast to that view of thinking. Jesus is saying, not so with you, but instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. Whoever must be going to be great among you is going to be your diaconus. The word for servant. The one that means a menial servant. The kind of person that you have running around doing your chores. Jesus says, that's the person who's great in the kingdom. Not only does he draw that contrast, but then secondly, you notice that there's a progression of the contrast. Because then he says, not only is this person that he's going to be great among you, will he be a servant, but then in verse 27, in fact, whoever wants to be first, you don't just want to be great, you want to aspire to the top. If you want to aspire to the top in the kingdom, he says, then you don't only become a servant, you become a slave. Now, the word slave there, a doulos, is a field hand. A person who had absolutely no rights. A person who did the most undesirable of all tasks and had no rights whatsoever to protect them. Jesus says, if you want to be saved, And the place you take is the lowest one possible. The place of a slave. A person with no status. A person who doesn't look for anybody to boss around because he realizes he doesn't have the right to do that. A person whose attitude is not, who can I exercise authority over? But who can I serve, whether it's through authority or not authority? But who can I serve in whatever position I've been placed in? That's not the kind of thing that I want to hear. I don't know about you. You know, but there's an awful lot in me that's going to fire for that first view of business. And you might say to yourself, oh boy, you know, here comes another heavy thing. You know, here comes this, another one. I'm just still dealing with the things of the last week, and now this one, you know, sort of tops it off. Well, if you view this as just simply another heavy, then you see that too soon. Hang on to the end, because Jesus has another point to what he's saying. Because he goes on, you see there in verse 28, to give a comparison. And that comparison is all important and vital to the understanding of all of what this is about. He gives there a comparison in which he says, just as the Son of Man did not come to be saved, but to save, and to give his life as a ransom for many. There's one view of greatness that says greatness is measured by how many people I boss around, by my recognition, by my credit, the kingdom that I build for myself. Not so among you, he says. If you're going to be great in the kingdom, you become a servant. If you're going to be first in the kingdom, you take the lowest place of a slave. Even as the Son of Man. That's interesting that he uses that title for himself, Son of Man. It's the title that all scholars will agree comes from Daniel 7, which is where it emanated. And where in Daniel 7 is this Son of Man seated? Well, in Daniel 7, verse 13 and 14, we read about the vision that Daniel had, for which he has seen the Ancient of Days and his feet, and all of the glory and the fire that he's describing there. And then he says in verse 13, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like the Son of Man. Now, what about that Son of Man? He's coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. And the Son of Man was given authority, glory, sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worship him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion. He will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. The very essence of the Son of Man is that he is a King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and his dominion will never pass away. And Jesus says, now I'm the Son of Man, and the Son of Man did not come to be saved. Doesn't make any sense. If there was anything that you thought about concerning the Son of Man, it was that you served him. But when the Son of Man came, he came to wield authority. Authority that would take the Roman government. And Jesus says, the Son of Man came not to be saved. So it's jarring. It's hard for us to take it in. The Son of Man will not just be saved, but to save. What does Jesus think the Son of Man do? He goes about and heals the sick. He sees dirty beggars filled with vermin and lice. And he touches them. And he takes hold of them and says, he's here. He goes to lepers, the untouchable of the society. Those that he stayed away from and wouldn't even go near, and Jesus touches lepers. And he saves them and makes them whole. This week I was waiting in the hospital and examined for something. And as I was waiting there, a number of people passed up and down the corridor. One fellow came over and sat beside me. A sort of a nervous, fat fellow that was just kind of very insecure, looked like he was very ill at ease in the whole situation. I found his demeanor and his approach and everything rather unattractive, and I had no interest in talking to him. I continued to do what I was doing, and as he got up and left, I thought, how unlike the attitude of the Son of Man is now. The king is old. There was no one. It was unattractive to him and bearing his father's image. No one that he would not touch, not embrace, and I decide who is worth my attention. I decide who is worth my touching and talking to. How am I, the Son of Man? And not only did he heal and touch, but we're told also that he taught the ignorant, that he appeared to be free in this passage. People that I wouldn't have even bothered with. I just write them off as unteachable. There's no reason to continue trying to have a ministry with these guys. And Jesus was a servant. And he continued to work with them. He continued to take from that raw material that seemed to hold such little potential. To me, that was about it. He served them with humility. You can read in John 13, when nobody else was willing to do it, he washed their feet. And he served them. What about you? How did Jesus serve you? Know how he served you? As he says here, Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And give his life as an answer to them. Jesus set his life as a payment. That you and I stand before a holy and a righteous God, a God before whom we stand dumbfounded, before whom we stand with our mouths closed to protect any innocence as our guilt comes sweeping down over us. As we realize that you are the God who knows everything about me, he knows how I've lived in disregarding his whole law, he knows how I've lived a totally self-centered life. He knows how I have not been concerned to honor him and to please him in all the things that I do. He knows that I stand before him naked, ashamed, and guilty. Jesus comes to you. He comes to you as our brother. He sees you and me in our very deepest need. Jesus says, I'm willing to meet that need. Jesus comes and at the very point of your deepest need, he gives his life as a ransom. He saved you by giving everything that he has and pouring out his life's blood. Think of Sam Burrell, a man raised in Australia, out of a very difficult background and home life. He came in his young manhood to know Jesus Christ. And for Sam Burrell to know Jesus Christ, there's to know him without his age. He looked north to Papua New Guinea and he saw the tribes of the Yali people who had never heard of Jesus Christ in Hidden Valley. And Sam Dale said that he was going to go there and be willing to make a beacon for the gospel in those valleys and mountains, the snow mountains, and then Papua New Guinea, now Elian Valley. And Sam Dale went and under the severest conditions to establish the beacon. He lived in the most difficult circumstances and most dangerous circumstances which you could imagine among cannibalistic people. Came in as the first white man, established communication with them, presented Jesus Christ to them. A people who flaunted their masculinity with tunic wars, who put their women down to such an extent that the suicide rate was 10 times higher than for the men, whose superstition held them in great bondage generation after generation. A warlike, impossible people. He found out what he'd ask of these people at the risk of his life, and at the forsaking of all convenience. At one time, he was seeking to go farther into one valley. He was shot with arrows 5 times in his body. He struggled under impossible odds to get back to the camp. He found a good ride at the camp and was taken then to a hospital and survived the wound right back into the village to continue to preach the gospel. You heard that after a while he had baptized a number of these people and had called on them to burn their fetishes. And in a great ceremony, these people burned the fetishes that they had worshipped, and all of these things went up in smoke, and it was a great display of the victory and the power of Jesus Christ. Like Sam Dale was willing to be their servant. You heard of other tribes to the west that had not ever heard the gospel, and being encouraged by the victory that God had given him over this period of years, there took a man with him and a number of carriers and went across these mountains, 10 to 12,000 foot passes. tried to establish communication with another village. What he didn't know was that other villages, having heard about the burning of the fetishes of their brothers and sisters, had spread the word throughout the valley that this white man comes into your village, kill him on sight. And so he came there to preach the gospel that offended him. As they arrived into the village, they knew that they were in danger. The men followed them outside in war cries. They followed them over a rope bridge. One of the sailors begged them to cut the bridge so that they couldn't be followed. His response was, "I won't cut the bridge because that will alienate them from further contact with the gospel. And we want to do everything possible to win them to Jesus Christ." And shortly after that, they caught up to them along a riverbank. The men surrounded him, and they cried out their war cry and began to fire arrows into his body. 1, 5, 10, 15, 20. By the time they were finished, they had shot 100 arrows into him, and they chopped up his flesh into little pieces. They also did this to his friend, the same thing, chopped up both of their bodies and carried them back to Ethan. They decided not to do that at the request of one of their elders. And through this, God used an amazing circumstance to bring others, in an amazing twist of events, to bring the gospel to those people. And to this day, there are now thousands of Yali people in Indian Valley to profess Jesus Christ. If you want to read that and follow the rest of the story to see how it comes out, this book, Lords of the Earth, by Don Richardson, tells the whole story. It's in our library. What I want you to understand is if you look at a man like that and say, "God's saving me." That's a man who is willing to lay down his life as a servant in an obscure place of the world because of his love for those people. That's nothing. That's nothing, dear friends, to what Jesus Christ is for your sins. Jesus Christ left heaven. And he laid down his life on a cross, having been mocked and scourged and crucified, so that he would be a ransom for men. Because even the Son of Man came not to be saved, but to save, and to give his life a ransom for you and for me. Not only then does Jesus tell us like that, but he went in it. You notice that comment. Jesus illustrated the lesson because he read in verse 29 that as his disciples and he were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. And two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, these men shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked him, formed his side. Yet they can't even have a party anymore without these beggars disturbing the peace. So we are having a great time. Jesus is in our midst, and we're enjoying his company. And all we hear is these two guys keep yelling out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." That spoils the fun, you know? And so the crowd tries to rebuke them. The crowd just cut them up and put them in their place. But Jesus comes from the scene. What does he do? You read in verse 32, Jesus stopped. And he went over to them. And Jesus said to them, "What do you want me to do to you?" But that's the significance of that statement. What Jesus is saying is, how can I save you? An illustration precisely placed in Matthew's ordering of events, a contrast with the attitude of the disciples, and even the crowd there, to illustrate exactly what he's been talking about. Even the Son of Man came not to be saved, but to save. So a couple of beggars, he stopped the party, all the procession, and he says, "How can I save you?" He said, "Oh Lord, you want to help." Verse 34 says that Jesus had compassion on him. And he gave him mercy. Why did he save him? Because he had compassion on him. Why do you and I serve? Out of compassion. What did Paul say in Galatians 5? Serve one another in love. Serve one another in compassion. So what's the application for all of us here? Well, can you say that you're a wife and a mother? Can you say that your whole life seems to consist of nothing but diapers and dishes, of meals and cleaning and preferring people around, of being somehow seemingly taken for granted and doing so many things that seem to have such little significance in the light of the world. You say that you work for the church. You say that you try to help some other Christians. You try to go out of your way to do something thoughtful, to do something that was needed as you thought would help someone else. You thought it would be appreciated, but it's hardly been a word of thanks. Have you even recognized that you did it? You say to yourself, I'm disgusted with that. Bad enough that I had to go out of my way and disrupt my schedule and do all of that, and nobody even cared. Next time I'm not going to be so foolish, let somebody else volunteer. You say that you tried to help somebody, a friend of yours. You tried to help the refugees, or some neighbor. And nobody's even noticed what you've done. You've done it. You know, coffee was a rather unrewarding task, a menial task, something that you say to yourself, anybody could have done that. But somebody had to do it, so I did it. And nobody cared. Nobody's even noticed. I didn't get any credit for it. And gradually, as you proceed through these kinds of things, you notice that your joy is being in collusion in this. You notice that there's a heaviness to your spirit. There's a lack of a real desire to continue this kind of an attitude that you see coming along. You feel taken for granted, even humiliated, even foolish at times, rather unhappy, rather out of touch with the joy that you would expect to come from such places. And meanwhile, you keep saying, Lord, give me the mind of Christ. Lord, make me more like Jesus in my life. Don't you see what the Lord's doing? He's asking you to pray. Don't you see that when we understand what's happening in that context, then serving and ministering take on a whole new understanding. They can be seen in a whole new light. Because what's really happening is that the Lord is enabling you to become what you are. What is that? Dead to yourself, to sin, and alive to Jesus Christ as his servant. God's giving you an opportunity to mortify that pride, that self-seeking, that touching on to my rights. And he's done that in a gracious and kind way. You see, if I do something and I get credit for it, if there's recognition for what I've done, then how do I know that what I did really didn't minister to me in the end? It was really that I got ministered to, I got credit for it in doing it. It's when I get no credit that I learn to be a servant. It's when I get no recognition that I begin to enter into the mind of Christ. Even the Son of Man did not come to be saved. You see, it's when I don't get that recognition that I'm not being served in having my own ego built up. It's then that I can try my motives to see why I really did that. To see if I did it because I wanted credit or because I really wanted to serve the Lord. I think of the time back in my serving with university when I was thinking about a prayer letter that I needed to write to. Letter that was not only for prayer but to my supporters, in order to show them why my ministry was worth supporting. Well, it was kind of the wrong time to write that letter. Lots of things were happening that weren't particularly rewarding. A number of my groups were not going through great growth and a great time of success. So as I weighed that and wondered, what am I ever going to put into this letter that people are going to think we're supporting, I was going to make a trip, good old Crossburg. Crossburg Street. Something was always happening at Crossburg that I could write about, and so I went up there with great anticipation of something to write into my letter. And I went up to Crossburg that had been growing and doubling and tripling and quadrupling in the months before. And as I got there, I found that Crossburg was on the rock too. And they were having some struggles and some discouragements, and I talked to the president of the group, who at that point was a woman, and as I talked with her and discussed this, and through that whole conversation, I know that I simply was laying on her, this group is not ministering to me. Why don't you shape up as a group? You know, you're really not honoring the Lord here. And I was simply very happy on them because they weren't ministering to me. Well, as I went back on the train from that visit, it became even apparent to me before anybody said anything that maybe that's what I was doing. From first suspecting that perhaps that was what I was doing and getting a little hard, I notified the president when I got back and I said, did you feel like I was laying a little heavy on you while I was there? Because I cried the whole night after you left. Yeah. Because I had come to be served. Oh yes, I might have touched it in terms of service. But my attitude was, I want to be served in my service. I'm looking for credit and recognition. And when I didn't get it, I laid heavy on the people who were supposed to be serving me. And God has to again and again tell me, my neighbor, why do I serve you? Why do we serve one another? This is because even the Son of Man came not to be served. And because of my love for Jesus Christ, who came and served me. But because I want to be served in some subtle way by credit and recognition. You think of your own under shepherd group. You know, there's two problems with fellowship. The one is that we operate on a very superficial level, and we don't indicate that we have any problems. We sort of sound like the tourist issues, and all our problems are in the past, and we don't let anybody in on our struggles. But the second problem is that once we get beyond that, and we begin to open up about our problems, we begin to admit that we have struggles in the Christian life, then we go to the other side, and we begin to focus on our problems. You begin to want to talk about my problems and pray for me in this regard. And let me tell you what's happening in my life. And we try to elicit sympathy from the group. And we look at the under-shepherd group as a place to go to be ministered to. And if I find that the group isn't listening enough to me, then I say, this group is wrong because they don't listen to me and my concerns. And even the Son of Man came not to be saved. That's the truth. And even when he poured out his revelation concerning his coming torture and death, the response that he got was not to be served. But he continued to say, well, that's supernatural. I can't do that in my own place. The only way I can do that is to not look to the people, but to look to Jesus. To look to Jesus and to understand that he is the one who himself is the Son of Man, that I worship, came to save me. But even when people fell down before Jesus Christ and they worshiped him, on no occasion did that happen to Jesus then said, well, that's so good, I'm glad you finally realized who I am around here. Now, would you please go get me a drink of water and maybe go get me a new pair of sandals and get me something to help me on my way? But Jesus in everything continued to save. Even if he is worshipped, Jesus continues to serve you and to me. He's gone back to heaven to prepare a place for you and for me. And Jesus Christ has gone to intercede for you and for me. Jesus Christ listens to you and to me as we call upon him. Even the Son of Man came not to be saved, but to save. And you and I lay hold of what Jesus made for us. And as we love him, and as we adore him as the one who came to serve, God will place in our hearts the attitude of a servant. The attitude of one who's willing to pray for the village one to save, not because I'll be recognized as praying for it, but because I want to serve. He will serve my brother and sister, not because I want to be recognized for it, but because I love Jesus Christ who served me. Even the Son of Man came not to be saved, but to save and give his life a ransom for many. That's it. Call, Lord God, Lord Jesus, you were equal with God. You had all of the glory of the Father that you bestowed us. Because you did not grasp onto that, you did not cling to it. Rather, you emptied yourself. You became man. And you took on the attitude of a servant. And humbling yourself to you, you became obedient unto God. even the anonymous death of a cross. You were crucified in order to save us. To save us sinners.